Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at cento.com, King Arthur at kingarthurflower.com, Cola Vida at colavita.com, and Wines of Portugal at winesofportugal.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Folks, welcome back. Mike Colomeco here, Food Talk. We are live. It's June. I have a guest in the studio. We'll get with my guest 2 seconds. I just want to give a shout out to some friends here in the city. Eric Korsch, a chef friend of mine, he and his wife ran Calliope for, I don't know, about a year. And one of my favorite restaurants, we actually filmed there, and then they closed. Who knows what happens? Bad partner. Who knows what the deal was there? But Eric's a super talented guy. He is now the new chef at North End Grill, which is down there in that, I shouldn't say this because it sounds so judgmental, but whatever. We're from New York, right? So it's that part of New York that's on the west side of the West Side Highway. It's basically Goldman Sachs and American Express country, to put it bluntly. It used to be beaches and sandy and nice, and now it's full of men and women in suits. I don't like the neighborhood at all. I don't like the feel of the neighborhood at all. But anyway, there's a restaurant down there called North End Grill that Danny Myers runs, and Danny's a quality guy. Goldman Sachs must have sensed they wanted to get a pro in, so they got Danny. So we opened up a Shake Shack down there, and I think one of those Blue Smoke or something. It's 3 Danny Myers restaurants all in the Goldman Sachs compound. But I have to tell you, went there last week or the week before, North End Grill. Eric Korsch has been there for about a month. He's tweaked the menu, and it was the best meal I ever had there. It's great. So if you live downtown and you don't mind hanging around in a dining room full of suits, ignore them if you do. That's what I did. The food's great, better than ever. So kudos to him. Also, my good friend Ariane Degas that runs D'Artagnan. Ariane, I've known her forever. I was a young buck, maybe 26 years old, 25 years old, sous chef at the Maurice restaurant in 1985 when they launched her business. They had the launch party at our restaurant. Her dad came over from Gascony, and it was all new to me, duck confit and all that stuff. Not so much anymore, huh? But Ariane's been a real fixture in the New York food scene with foie gras, with confit, with all of the goodies that celebrate really American ingredients now, but inspired by the southwest of France. So they have this event called the Duckathon that they had every year for, I'm guessing, 6 or 7 or 8 years. But it used to be only for industry insiders. You had to be in the business. It was not open to the public. And it would be all kinds of funny stuff, chefs doing crazy skits and funny stuff and cooking ducks and the usual drinking and debauchery. This year, it's open to the public. So if you go to The Duckathon, which sounds just like it sounds, theduckathon.com, it's June 14th, 12 to 5 at Met Pavilion. First time open to the public. Bunch of chefs will be there competing, doing different stuff. Anita Lowe will be there. Shane McBride, you know, Anita Lowe's from Anissa. Shane McBride is Keith McNally's chef at all his restaurants, Balthazar, etc. David Waltuck, formerly of Chanterelle. Saul Balton of Soul. Damian Wise. It's an A-list of talent. $60 per person. A lot of great food to eat. And the proceeds go to charity for Action Against Hunger. So again, that is theduckathon.com. Hosted by the great company D'Artagnan, June the 14th, 12 to 5 at Met Pavilion. Visit them at theduckathon.com. Last shout out last night, had great dinner last night with some old friends and some really great new ones. Gabriella Gershenson, who I've known since she was at Time Out New York, and then when she was at Sever, now she's at Rachel Ray. Real smart kid. Ryan Sutton, who was the food critic for Bloomberg and is now one of the 3 national food critics for Eater, based in New York, was at the table. A couple of other friends who were just real smart. A woman that writes for The Times, whose dad and mom were there. They were great. Anyway, we were at a restaurant I love called Le Mangeoir, which is Christian Delouvrier. He's the chef. He's going to be there for the rest of this year. And if you want to try great classic French food, you don't have to look any further. It's M-A-N-G-E-I-O-R-E, Le Mangeoir. A stuffy neighborhood, not one of my hangs. It's 52nd and 53rd on 2nd Avenue. But you know what? That's why they have the subway. Or Uber or bicycles. Great, great French food. We had a great meal. It was great to see Christian. So that's my shout outs for the day. My guest is Eugenia Bone. She was on this program when we first got launched last October, November. I had her on my old show. I think I did WRR, didn't I?
Yeah.
I think I did. And you're the, well, what's your title? Mycological something, something, something.
Yeah. I'm the president of the New York Mycological Society.
Thank you. Now, why that would have been so hard for me to say, I don't know, but...
That's okay.
So, you know, special ed's where I usually feel most comfortable.
Well, it's a big word.
So tell me, you sent me this picture, and you're so funny. So it was, you just got back, what, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
From where and what were you doing?
So it's morel season, right? And the morels in the East Coast can be pretty slender picking. You have to really work hard. And that's just not my bag, even though I'm the president of the society. And I should put forth a really good image. What I really like to do is fly to a place where I know there are a lot of morels and pick them as many as I can and then bring them home.
Makes sense.
So I flew to Sacramento, rented a car, drove to the Tahoe National Forest, which had had a forest fire last summer.
So tell me, because you were explaining this to me.
Yeah.
So this picture wasn't, I opened it up, it was attached on the computer.
Yeah.
And it was one that showed like a huge pile of morels.
Like a monster bag.
And yeah. Your foot was there for scale. And I'm like, that's a shit ton of morels.
Yeah.
And then it was a picture of your hands that looked like a vigneron post harvest where you were just ash and dirt and stuff on your finger. So what is it between fires and mushrooms? What's the synergy?
Well, it's just morels.
Just morels.
Yeah,
okay.
Just morels. So what happens is that in the spring, after a forest fire in certain parts of the country, morels come up in humongous amounts. Given that there's enough rain in the spring. And you wouldn't think, you know, since it's been very dry in California, that there would have been a good morel season, but there was. So,
right, because it's been dry. They had a huge drought.
Right. It's been very dry. But there was rain in the Sierras, which is where the Tahoe National Forest is. So what happens is that the morels grow from fungus that lives underground on maybe on the roots of the trees and on debris, whatever, and underneath the ground. And when a forest fire happens, the fungus's symbiotic partners, the trees, are all like scorched. I mean, when you go into these forests, it's just charcoal. That's what you were seeing. The dirt on me was charcoal, like I was a chimney sweep or something. In fact, morels have even been known to grow in people's fireplaces. I don't know what it is. They kind of can dig that environment. But the real reason why the morels come up in such numbers is because the fungus has to get the hell out of there. Their partners, their symbiotic partners, are dead, and they've got to find new habitat. So the fruiting bodies come up. That's what the mushroom is. The spores get dispersed, and they float around looking for new habitat.
Wow. Now, and they'll find it, I guess, because it's nature and it works in its own mysterious... So what are these...
I think nature's good at
this
stuff.
Will these trees survive, or were the trees gone?
Trees are gone.
Gone.
Trees are gone. The lumber companies were in there, taking out the snags. And also, I have to say, they were taking out a lot of stuff that wasn't snags. So it didn't look completely legit to me, because there is just a lot of timber coming out of that forest.
Give men chainsaws.
Yeah,
even down by me. Every time I hear a chainsaw, I'm like, oh, really? We trimming trees? Are we taking them down again, boys?
And
what starts as a trim usually ends up as a screw. Anyway, so... They're supposed to be doing some good work, but they ended up probably taking down a lot of
Well, you know, they think they're
whatever.
Doing what they, yeah,
do
they're doing
what do.
They do best.
Chop shit down.
So the snags are hanging out there, and the real, like, danger of being in those woods is falling snags. You know, they're moaning in the wind.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah, they're
so
huge,
a snag is
black.
This tree that is just done. It's done, it's charred, it's black.
It's like a gigantic black cindery spike.
And as the wind blows, you can actually hear them kind of creaking unsteadily.
Yeah.
And if it blows hard enough in the right direction,
bang.
Bang.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully not on your patch of morels. So,
wow.
So I hooked up with this guy I know, David Campbell. He's got this, he does these, he used to be the president of the San Francisco Mycological Society, which is a huge group, much bigger
imagine?
Than ours.
I mean, San Francisco and mushrooms. I mean,
oh,
just
man,
not even think
lot.
About that. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of enthusiasts.
Yes, a lot of enthusiasts.
Yes.
It's the West
Coast.
It's...
So we have a lot of enthusiasts in New York City, too, by the way. I
happen
to know that for a fact.
Year, but anyway.
But the So David, he and I hooked up. He's also a professional mushroom hunter, you know, and he leads tours. He leads people to do truffle hunting tours in Italy and all over. So he does morel tours. He was actually taking people into this forest, and they'd pay $200 or whatever, and he would take them to the patches in this burn.
And they get morels.
Yeah, and then there was this guy, wonderful. Yeah, and there was a chef cooking at night. They were in a lodge, and, you know, it's this whole kind of way to party over a weekend. But I went with him solo, you know, and it was really about harvesting. And we found a lot of morels.
How many did you weigh it? Pounds, kilos, a lot?
Well, my license, which I had to pay for.
Whoa, so it's like fisheries and game and fisheries. Oh,
yes.
Really?
Although
with mushrooms?
It's a patchwork. It changes state by state, even forest to forest.
Well, that's the way everything is in America.
Yeah, so it's a patchwork of regulation. So it can be kind of hard. You just have to figure it out, you know, depending on the fire.
So you got a permit.
So I got a permit. I paid $20, and then, which is cheaper than killing a duck, actually. And then they...
cheaper than killing a duck.
Yeah, duck permits are expensive.
Like, shotgun?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I do that in the fall.
Really? They shoot them at me all the time. I have to ask my hunting friends down in South Jersey.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, I'll keep quiet. So $20, got your permit.
$20, got me a permit, and I was...
And it allows you to harvest how much?
5 pounds.
Jesus. If you paid 40, could you get 10?
Nope.
So 5 pounds your limit?
5 pounds is my limit.
Why?
You know, it's arbitrary because people say, oh, you know, if you pick all the mushrooms, then they won't, you know, they won't reproduce.
Or is
they,
that this, true or this, is this not true?
No, it's nonsense.
Thank you, because I was in Poland.
Make sense.
I think I mentioned this to you. I was in Poland in the fall, and it was September, and it was a rainy season there, rain almost every bloody day. And Poland, there's not that many autostradas. There's a lot of just two-lane roads. That's kind of how you get around Poland. So it takes forever.
Right.
And big van, me and the camera guys and our hosts and everybody and the driver. And about every couple of miles, you just see a car pulled off the side of the road. And a trail, sometimes no trail. And then once in a while, you'd see the people attached to the car. And it would be a lot of times these older couples with these big gnarly boots on with baskets.
Yeah.
And my cameraman made the comment of, well, if everybody's doing this, which is an intelligent comment to make, aren't they going to deplete the mushroom stocks? And then I just thought, and I don't know, I mean, I just thought, well, if they're up already and they're dropping spores around, they're doing their job.
Right.
I mean, whether they fall on the ground and die and decay and become dirt again is a waste.
Right.
Snip them, take them home and eat them. I don't think it's going to deplete the biomass of mushrooms.
Right.
So that's true.
That's true. Now, that said, there's sensible practices and there's kind of asshole practices. So if there's sensible practices, then what you do is you're not going to pick little tiny baby mushrooms. Mm. You're going to pick the nice big mature ones that have already sporulated and there's plenty of spore, you know. I mean, they produce billions. This one scientist told me that if every spore, mushroom spore, that was floating around in the atmosphere was to germinate at once, the bio load would be so great it would throw the Earth off its orbit.
That'd be great science fiction.
Well, it's like certainly mushroom people think so.
Hell yeah. I gotta talk to Jim Jarmusch about that. That could be the next Jarmusch movie.
Yeah, that's high concept, that's for sure.
Your limit was 5 pounds. That was it.
That was what I officially brought home.
Okay.
Uh huh.
Well,
so
that's a pretty. In the morels don't. I mean, they're not the lightest mushrooms. They're not like portobellos or.
But that's not what you saw in that picture either.
Shh. It was no. You had it on a scale. It was 5 pounds.
There you go.
That's all I saw.
There you go. So then I bring him home in a duffel, and I got stopped at Sacramento Airport.
No, that was my next question. Was how do you check your bag?
No, you do carry on because I didn't want him to get banged around, you know, and I don't want him to sit on the tarmac or something because they're mushrooms and they could get really moldy.
Yeah.
And they're full of moisture. I mean, they're mostly water.
And we should talk about mushroom storage. Don't let me forget. For those of you that are going to listen to this, if you're like me, I love mushrooms. If I could go vegan, I don't know about that. Vegetarian for like 4 or 5 days if you gave me a huge supply of mushrooms.
Yeah.
I can substitute all my proteins for a variety of mushrooms until I got bored and I'd go back to eating.
And you'd lose weight. And you'd lose weight. There's been great studies
on mushrooms
on that.
And losing weight.
Well, if you substitute meat with substitute mushrooms in meat in your recipes instead of meat, right?
It makes sense.
Then you take in less calories.
Makes
the
sense.
Thing that's more key is that because of the high grade protein, it has all 9 amino acids. So if that high grade protein means you don't get hungry between meals. And that's where the kicker is. It fills you up like a burger, but you don't take in the burger calories.
I knew I loved them for a reason. All right, so you're at the airport. You got a backpack with 5 pounds of morels.
There
going
you go.
Through security.
It's a
and
big
like,
backpack.
Lady, what's this?
Yeah, and then, you know, I can see on the other side that it's going back and forth through the x-ray.
Screen
the guy's
thing.
Looking at it, and then he goes back, and he looks at it again. So he's definitely feeling. This is in Sacramento, which is a capital, but it's still kind of a small town.
So
he's getting a little weirded out, and I hear he calls over somebody else, and I could tell they're getting a little excited, like maybe some contraband, because, you know, it might have been a slow day at Sacramento Airport. I don't know. But they were certainly getting a little, you know, worked up. And then finally another person came and took a look, and she was like, no, they're just mushrooms. And they were, like, pissed off at me. I disappointed them, you know, not to have delivered, like, some kind of, I don't know, ammunition, something a little bit more sexy. Okay. They do look like little grenades, so maybe they
How
thought
big were they
were...
Show me, so they were, like, 3-4 inches. They're big.
Yeah, I had a lot of big ones, but I cooked them all, depending on the size, all different ways. Like, the really big ones, you're supposed to cut your... morels in half part of the commercial.
My next question is, as a chef, I've handled morels for years.
Yeah.
And because of... So morels are very unusual. For those of you that don't know what they look like, I'll fill you in as best I can. Most mushrooms have the stem and a cap, and the cap is pretty closed, except the bottom, which has those little gills on the bottom. And
No. The morel's the one
I'm not talking about morels yet. So,
okay.
Every other mushroom, most of the other mushrooms look that way.
Yeah.
The morels, on the other hand, have a cap, but the entire top is crenellated.
Yeah.
It's crown-shaped, and it's just full of pores. It's full of little nicks and crannies.
Yeah.
So my question was always... There was like a, kind of a chef's thing where you don't want to wash mushrooms because they absorb water. You really don't put them in water because they tend to be sponges. So we clean them with airbrushes or soft.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Soft brush.
Did you learn that in cooking school?
Well, we improvise. So how do you clean morels?
You wash them in water.
You do. You just wash
them in
water.
Of course. They've got forest debris. They've got like, squirrel pee-pee on them. Yeah, wash them.
I remember squirrel pee-pee. Jesus, that's a food group. Well, I remember getting them with like pine needles and stuff, and you just don't want to serve that to customers. You don't want people pulling
stuff out
of their mouth.
You don't
want
to eat it even if you're serving it to yourself. So you swish them, you take the morels or any mushroom for that water. You could put it in a bucket of water, you swish them around, and then you cook them.
Okay.
The thing is you don't want to wash them and then put them in a plastic bag and then put them in the fridge or they'll rot.
Right.
So you treat them the same way you do as berries. You keep them in a paper bag in the fridge.
That's my next. So if you buy mushrooms at home, and I've made this a vacation. If you don't know, normally we put stuff in plastic bags in refrigerators or
not a mushroom.
Tupperware.
Yeah.
Mushrooms want to be in a paper bag
that's
almost slightly open. So the air is kind of moving around.
Right.
That's unusual.
And they'll hold, like a morel will hold quite a while. I mean, a week easily.
Yeah, they're sturdy little buggers.
They're very sturdy. And so you can find them in stores right now. You know where I actually get good deals on morels, which is so, you're not going to believe this.
Don't tell me like Costco.
No, Eataly.
Because
it's such
good
an
expensive.
Yeah.
Good deal in Italy doesn't go in the same sentence usually.
It's such an expensive. But, you know, it's like, I think maybe because the vegetables and stuff are all, they're kind of for show, you know? It's not like people are coming and buying their groceries for dinner
the
there.
I used to buy vegetables.
Oh, it's a
cool
good
stuff.
Deal. It's a good deal.
They would get Puntarello when nobody else had Puntarello. They get really beautiful Italian Trevise. They would have some really good salad greens.
And
stuff
the prices are competitive.
So, what's a morels cost per half a pound, quarter pound, ounce? How do they sell them?
Usually they sell them by the half pound, and so I'm seeing about $30 right now.
That's a lot of morels, man. Half pounds of morels is you're going to feed a bunch of people.
You know what? It's so worth it. They're just so good.
How do you cook them? So tell me how you cook them.
So the really big ones this year I stuffed with like lamb meatball mixture and then baked them, and they were really good, although people stuff them with all kinds of crazy stuff, crab and, you know.
So you're up. You're going into the tube, you think?
No, cut them in half.
And then
put the meatball in there.
Gotcha.
Yeah, because they're hollow inside. Right, that's the beauty of them. But they're really flavorful and, as you said, sturdy. So then bake them, right? So then a bunch of them, the last time I made them, I cooked quail with shallots, marsala, and the morels. And a lot of butter. And a little cream and some tarragon. So that was like
sauteed
a stew.
The morels, sauteed. Or you braise.
Now, first get the birds done.
Okay.
And then add the, with the shallots, and then add the morels.
Okay.
It's a take on a really famous French dish that calls for chicken with morels and a type of sherry, a sherry-like wine, and cream and tarragon.
All right.
Anyway, so then I also made pasta though. With morels and botarga, you know, so al olio. So that was a kind of mare monte.
Right.
Yeah, beautiful. And I made veal marsala with morels.
You had morels every night for 10 days.
Well, then I froze them and I dried them. And I was going to bring you some, and then I thought, well, you know, I don't know him well enough. So, you know, I did bring you a present.
We didn't bring me morels? Why? You have to know someone to bring the morels? Is there something I don't know about?
Let's just say on our, like, 10th anniversary or something.
Or for crying out loud.
But you know what this is?
It smelled like maple syrup.
I know. Those are good.
This isn't a morel. This is some kind of...
No, that's a really beautiful prosciutto rind. I got a whole bunch of it. I got a little more than I could handle, so I thought maybe you could use it.
You know what I do with this stuff? I dice it up, and I render it in pans, and I instead of using oil for cooking, I use fat, bacon, grease, and it's like a new... It's like, why use seed oils that you're buying at the supermarket that are just these hexane extractions when you can have a chunk of fat like this?
Yeah.
Chop it up fine.
And it can, and freeze is great.
Yeah, this is great.
This was frozen. I mean, it's warmed up a little in the subway, but
no, it's cold.
It's okay.
It's cold.
It's cold.
It's cold. It's not going to go anywhere.
I just put a hunk of it in when I cook beans or soup.
Anything.
Yeah.
Anything. Fat goes good with everything. Let's talk. Do we even talk about truffles?
Well, we can. I went truffle hunting in Oregon last month.
So let's talk about...
Ago.
I mean, it's a big topic. So let's talk about American truffles, because I'm curious. Yeah. So in Europe, to the best of my knowledge, there's three varieties. Melanosporum, Estivium, and I forget... So the black ones are Melanosporum?
Right.
That's Burgundian the Burgundian classic French black truffle.
Right. That's the Perigord.
The Perigordian truffle. Thank you. The classic. It's you often in sauce Perigordian. It's traditionally cooked in things.
Right.
It's black. When you cut them open, it's very dark. It's got a little striation of white through it. But the bigger ones tend to be dark and very firm. The Italians have the white truffles, which are they tend to be eaten raw.
Right.
They're harvested in and around Alba with, you've done it a million times. A couple
Tuber
of times.
Magnetum Pico. Is
Thank
the
you.
Name, the Latin.
And then there's the Estivium, which is the summer truffle.
Right. I love those.
Which
it's kind of barky. And
everyone thinks they're kind of throwaways, but they're really nice to shave and just finish stuff with.
Yeah.
Again, you eat them raw on things.
Yeah.
So what do we have in America? What family, what genus? Are they naturally occurring?
Yeah. Oh, there's truffles everywhere. There's two kinds of truffles growing in Central Park, you know. They're just not all edible. They're not all tasty to us. None of them are considered to be poisonous, or they're not generally considered to be a poisonous type of fungus. They're a mushroom that grows underground, basically. A mushroom that has evolved to grow underground for whatever environmental reasons. So they're all over. There's lots and lots of different kinds of truffles. But the ones that we like to eat have evolved to attract certain animals, particularly swine. But, you know, other truffles have evolved to attract squirrels. They would smell them and then dig them up and spread the spores and so on. So in Oregon, there's two kind of truffles that are of culinary value. Mm. And one is the Tuber Oregoniense.
So named after Oregon, basically.
Yeah, so it's the Tuber of Oregon, right. And so that's a white truffle, and it's really garlicky and has that real strong BO quality that, you know, we love in a truffle.
Yeah, funk.
It's very funky, very sexy, very like I can't stop smelling myself sort of thing. Yeah, it's compulsive. But it's a different, much more garlicky, I think.
What color are they?
They're white. That's the Tuber Oregon.
Harvested?
And they're harvested in the winter. And I went out and hunted them. They're harvested with dogs or by raking under trees. And they rake up they grow under Douglas fir.
See, there's this synergy, right? So in Europe, I know with the white truffles, there's shrub oak. There's certain vines that they like. There seems to be a connection between the proliferation of these truffles
and
species.
Well, it's the fungus, which is like the tree, the apple tree, and the fungus is like an underground apple tree, and the truffle is like an apple. So the fungus is growing on the roots of other plants, and they have a symbiotic relationship with other plants. In the case of truffles, you know, some mushrooms aren't the fruiting bodies of fungus that have symbiotic relationships. I mean, they grow lots of different ways. So the truffles always have a plant, a partner. For the truffles of Oregon, they're Douglas fir.
Hmm.
for morels, like what they call natural morels, or morels that are living, morels that are associated with living or semi-dead trees, it's elm, tulip poplar, and apple, for example, right around here.
Before we get back to truffles, and I just want to ask you this question, too. There is in Europe, we're relatively new. I mean, your father was Italian-American. Mm-hmm. My grandparents were both Italian-Americans, and my mom's dad would go out and foraging all the time. Even though he lived in Philadelphia, there was a golf course adjacent to his house, public golf course. And he would go out on that golf course and just bring stuff back.
Yeah.
Fungus off of trees, like those things that just grow that look, I mean, they're heavy. And of course, anything he could, dandelions and mushrooms off the ground. And they kind of knew what to eat and what not to eat because they'd done this in the old country. And
right.
No one was getting sick or dying. There is a morel called a false morel in Europe.
Yeah.
And because the
It's here, too.
Is it? Oh, it's my question. So how do you... How do you tell the...
You know what? Because it looks like...
It's not exactly as perfect. It looks kind of...
Right. Like, so a morel looks like a little bit like a brain with these crenellated spaces.
Right.
Whereas a Gyromitra esculente, which is edible, it's just that you have to treat it right because it's got hydrazine in it, which is this sort of similar to rocket propellant. So the false morel, it looks like a really like a brain that's very warped and unhappy and sick.
Yeah.
You know, it's misshapen. It doesn't have that conical quality. It doesn't have any regularity to it. It's just like a blob. And it's very, if you put the two side by side, you really have
The
morel,
the shape of it's like a Christmas tree in a way that's a little more uniform. It's pitched correctly. And then those crenellations have an order to them. And then the false morels look just like deformed morel.
They're totally deformed. But
they do sell them, and I guess there's some way to get that stuff out of them. Smoking them
you
or
have
drying
it's
them
because
or,
the hydrazines are heat labile. I think that's how you pronounce the word. What
so
that
if you
means
them up, if you heat them up, they die.
If you heat them up, then the chemicals, the chemical compounds break apart. So they just go back to being little molecules floating around. Yeah.
One more thing before we get back to morels. While we were in
and you
Poland,
have to oh I got to tell you have to cook morels too. You know that. Because morels have hydrazine in them too, so but it's only a problem if you eat them raw. You know,
so you can't eat morels raw.
Oh, if you eat morels raw, you get sick. Yeah,
no kidding. Well, there you, folks. That's a public service announcement
there
right
you
there.
Go.
That's a reason to listen to the show. So even if you're cleaning them and you want to taste a couple, just don't do it. Cook
don't
them.
Don't do it. Just
right.
cook them, and then and don't worry how long do you have to cook them. Because cook them until they're cooked, and that's
so
good.
We're in Poland, and there's one of the girls. Tags along with us in one of the national parks, and she's like a mushroom expert. She harvests all the time, can identify 130-some varieties that grow in Poland alone. And she was telling us that there was a mushroom that women come in from some of the Eastern European countries to Poland to get because if they feed it to their husbands, they can't drink alcohol.
Oh, yeah. Tippler's Bane, they call it.
So what sounds
it grows
like something
here, too.
Lord of the fucking Rings.
Yeah.
So it's some mushroom that it's edible, and then you eat it.
Delicious.
You're all fine.
Yeah.
But if, if you eat it today, you can't drink for 60 days.
Well, it's not, it depends. I mean, that.
Depends on the guy?
It depends. Okay. But the thing ultimately, the mushroom and alcohol don't mix. And what happens is you get something called antabuse poisoning. You know, like alcoholics will take a medicine called antibusol, I think it is.
I've heard about it. It's something new. It's made, I think it's actually might be made from these mushrooms.
I don't know. I have no idea.
Right.
Well, or it's a chemical, you know, it's a synthesized chemical. So, so if you have a big plate of it and you have a glass of wine with dinner, you'd probably be like barfing for the next 2 days. I mean, I don't think it won't kill you. I mean, most poisonous mushrooms aren't killers.
No, these are just...
They just make
give you
diarrhea.
These have this horrible relationship with alcohol. And
you're
like, if you feed your... Well, that's what they told me. I don't know if it was a wives' tale. They said if they feed their husbands this, they're pretty good. The guys can't drink for like 30 days.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, there's a lot of variations specimens of the same species. So a specimen growing in, well, let's say Chernobyl is going to have certain qualities that is different from a specimen that's growing in New York City.
Makes sense. Hold on for 1 second. Are my next guests here? Okay, great. Sorry about that. We didn't get truffles. Well, that'll give us something to talk about next fall.
Oh, we can always talk about them. And I can tell you more in the future about Oregon truffles, which is a pretty cool...
Yeah, and maybe what we'll do is we'll cover the whole truffle thing, because once you're... I've got two more shows off for a couple of months. I'm taking the summer off to just be a space cadet at the beach, which I'm really good at. So I'll be back live in October, which gets us into white truffle season. And the beginning of black truffle season. And a perfect time to sort of talk about truffles, the myth, how to buy, how to store, how to eat, where to get them, where they come from, and this crazy, mysterious relationship they have with the world around them.
Well, with the trees. It's the beautiful. Trees. It's a beautiful relationship.
My guest has been Eugenia Bone. Your book is titled...
My mushroom book is Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms.
Totally cool book. Have it
Thank
in my
you.
House. Totally
oh, good,
cool.
Good.
All about mushrooms. You've got a book coming out in the fall.
I do.
We'll talk about that in the fall, and that's going to be
called... Fantastic. That's The Kitchen Ecosystem.
Okay. Yeah. Looking forward.
Thanks.
Have a great summer. If I don't
you
see
too.
You, we're going to take a quick spot. And then I've got a couple of really great guests. I've got Mike Mills, who, if you're in the barbecue world, he is known as the master. He's got 17th Street Barbecue. He's won all these world champions. We'll intro him. He's here with his daughter, who is fruit did not fall far from the tree. Let's put it that way. And I have the pit master from Skylight in Aiden, North Carolina, who's also going to be with us today. They've been here since 1947. It's Carolina barbecue, so it's a different style. It's, you know, this is my two favorite kinds of barbecue. So that'll be my next segment, and we'll talk about that and the Big Apple barbecue taking place this weekend in Manhattan, Saturday and Sunday. Stay tuned for that right after this. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms. Really small, like a half an acre apiece, and that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, hand pick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning, the factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano, that's what I use. Hey folks, Mike Calameco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelf. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. Commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean. You've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, port is the birthplace of ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. I could keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. Of the sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you spot by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Welcome back. Michael Lemeco here, Food Talks the Show. This is a great weekend in New York City. Once a year, is this the 10th or 11th, 12th year?
12th. 12th year.
12th year. We filmed the 10th year, so we filmed 10th year. So 12 years ago, Danny Myers, who is a visionary New York restaurateur, a man who's made his mark on the city in more than one ways, but certainly in the restaurant community, he's a legend. He opened Blue Smoke Barbecue right off of Madison Square Park way back when. And because it's New York and everybody's an asshole and everybody has an opinion, everybody was shitting on Danny because it wasn't authentic barbecue. It was too much this. It was too much that. It wasn't. And, you know, what New Yorkers know about barbecue, you could write on the back of a postage stamp, especially back then. But opinions are opinions. And Danny, being smart, rather than just telling everyone to go screw themselves, Danny said, oh, okay, well, I'll figure this out. And he got this great idea to invite really the best of the best, the all-stars of barbecue, to come to New York 12 years ago for a weekend, and he's going to call it the Big Apple Barbecue, and it would represent regional barbecue styles from around the country. And literally, the crews would bring in their pits, their fuel, sometimes their protein, haul it in. I guess you come over the GW Bridge. I don't know how you bring that stuff in. Holland Tunnel, Lincoln Tunnel, if they let you through. They would set up on Thursday or Friday morning, and by Friday night, Madison Square Park was just engulfed in smoke. And for the next 2 days, New Yorkers, starting at 11 o'clock till I don't know when it closes, could avail themselves of the best authentic barbecue in America in New York City. It was kind of Danny's way of saying, shut up and take this. Well, 12 years later, it's a huge hit. It's going to be this weekend. It's great. If you haven't been, you're crazy. If you think you like barbecue, if you think you know barbecue, great, but I advise you to come to Manhattan on this weekend and meet the real deal. So, to that end, I've got three guests on the show. I've got Mike Mills, who's got 17th Street Barbecue. In the 90s, he was a member of the Apple City Barbecue team. I could go on and on. Four-time world champion. Memphis in May. Memphis in May is like, I don't know what it is, like the Augusta. It's like the World Series of barbecue. 1992 grand champion at the Jack Daniels barbecue competition, which is, again, you know, this is like winning the heavyweight title. I think he has a clearance for Air Force One. Is that true? Air Force One, a clearance for Air Force One.
Yes, I have that.
He has a book, which is crazy. He's here with his daughter, so there's a generational component here. And his daughter is just stoked in the business, loves it too. Same story. Loves it. So you guys are going to talk about what you do. And then I've got Sam Jones here from Skylight Inn. We're talking about North Carolina barbecue. Aiden, pulled pork, really beautiful stuff. If you don't know how this is done, take a pig and you butcher it and you split it in half and you get some really good coal going, find that temperature that you like. And 17, 18 hours? About how long?
16, 18 hours.
16 to 18 hours for a half, which would weigh about 100 and some pounds of a hog. And then when it's all done, when they think it's ready, and you're watching it the whole time, I mean, there's no walking away from this stuff, it just gets chopped up, like bump, bump, bump. The crispy skin gets mixed in with the meat, the bits, all the parts, a little bit of sauce, a little bit of vinegar. And at the Skylight Inn, it's pretty much one menu. It's a sandwich.
That's it. It's a three-item barbecue cornbread coleslaw. That's it.
All right, Mike Smith, let's start with you, if you don't mind. And actually, you're third generation, by the way.
Yes, sir.
Third generation. Goes back to 1947, so we've got barbecue royalty in the house here. How did you get started, Mr. Mills?
Well, barbecue, my father was a barbecuer. This is all I've known as a kid growing up. I can remember standing in the crib watching my dad in the backyard barbecuing. And it's just been passed down through the years. My mother and dad was always in hopes of having a barbecue place one day. Technically, my dad never owned a barbecue pit, so to speak. He always dug a hole in the ground, put some rocks around, maybe some tin around it, or concrete blocks, and some old tin from a barn, and burn his coals off on the side, pretty much like Sam's family does it today, because it was back in the 40s at that point in time. And not ever knowing that I was ever going to end up being in the barbecue world, I've always barbecued, been around it all my life, not ever knowing that I would end up doing this for a living. I always did it just for the fun and the family and the camaraderie between friends. It was just a way of life.
And I'll tell you something, as an East Coast city kid that doesn't know shit about barbecue, I mean, you can't know anything about stuff unless you've been doing it for a good part of your life, right? We filmed 2 years ago, the 10th anniversary, and Friday night was the funnest scene because everybody knows everybody. A lot of times you guys are competing against each other. I mean, you know, you'd be against other pitmasters for the Jack Daniels and for the Memphis in May. This isn't a competition. This is a celebration. And to see everybody just out there having fun. The sun sets on the park, there's smoke coming up, there's moonshine being passed around, and everybody, all sorts of shit. It really is a community, isn't it?
It really is. It's a culture.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a concept. It's just something that we all feel. We're all there together. Even in competitions, there's an hour segment in a competition that you're out to win that competition. At the same time, if your fellow barbecuer needs something, here, what do you want? I got it. You know, it's yours. But for that 30 minutes or that hour during that judging period of time, we're each hoping that we win. If not, I'll see you next competition. I'll see you next Saturday.
And leading into this, I mean, you guys, for the competitions, you're awake for about 24 hours, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Because you have to. I mean, you're attending. These are live fires. We're not talking about setting a gas stove or a CVAP for 3 1/4 and watching Netflix for the next 6. You're tending to the fire, regulating the fire, regulating the heat, moving the meat around. It's crazy.
Well, as Sam just told you, it's 16, 18 hours, you know, in order to be able to cook a hog. And, of course, he's cooking multiple hogs during this period of time, and they're continually going on and off. So, yes, there's somebody there tending the pit, tending to the fire, making sure that everything stays on pace all the way through the whole process.
And your specialty is ribs?
Ours is ribs.
Is there a style? Because I don't want to misspeak. Is there a style to your barbecue that you would give it a name?
I would call it a Memphis-style rib. It's a drier rib. We use baby backs as our main rib. There's all kinds of different ribs where ours is not real wet. It has more of a dry rub on it.
I remember eating them, and I just remember, like, separating the bones. They just come apart. And then the meat's got that red section in it, like, that's in, that's just, like, cooked into it. The flavor was unbelievable. And this was just something you learned over time.
It was something, yes, I learned this over time. I learned it through friends, through my family, and other barbecuers that I picked up and learn from them. We all learn from each other.
How long are your baby backs on smoke for?
They're normally on about six and a half hours. It's all a matter of a feel, more so than, you can't time barbecue. You have to feel it. You know when it's ready. Even though you'll take the temperature of it, you still, again, you feel it and you know when it's ready.
Amy, tell me about you getting into barbecues. There's not a lot of women in this. I mean, more. I see more and more, I suppose. But it's pretty much a guy's game. Am I wrong about that?
It is a guy's game, but that's okay. I can be. I can get in there.
Good.
I feel really fortunate. I've sort of come full circle. I moved away from home. I went to journalism school. I lived in Dallas and in Boston. I actually still divide my time between Boston and Southern Illinois. But I've come full circle back into the business. I wrote our book, Peace, Love, and Barbecue, and I'm working on a new book called Praise the Lard. It'll be out soon. Very exciting. And I really feel that nobody can do what I do. You know, I couldn't pay someone to do what I do for our business. You have to be all in. You got to go whole hog. You've got to, you know, eat, sleep, and breathe it. And we definitely do that at 17th Street. And I think that's why in this little tiny town of less than 8,000 people, you know, people come from all over the world to see us. And that's why we're so excited to be on this stage in New York, because we get to see people from everywhere, you know, people, friends we've made over the last 12 years. People used to come, they were dating, then they got married, and now they're bringing their little children to
right,
see us.
Right.
It's so cool to see that evolution over the past 12 years.
And do you have sometimes New York chefs help you out for this or no?
Well, we actually have, this year, we have somebody from Union Square Events who's coming to kind of hang out with us and learn a little bit. We have a whole cadre of people we brought with us and some volunteers who've tagged along to help
us. Yeah, no, because I know some of the New York chefs. I was surprised one of the years
Laurie Morin from La Bernadette helped us last year. Pastry chef at La Bernadette, right?
It's just crazy. So I remember seeing her, and I remember a couple of years ago seeing Shane McBride, who's the chef at Balthazar now.
Shane and Damon Wise.
Damon Wise, who was the chef at Lafayette. I'm like,
Chris Lilly.
Okay.
They have their own barbecue team, too.
Okay. Because I know Shane went to Memphis in May.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then he was at Augusta.
And Lauren Hirschberg from Craft Bar. The three of them have a barbecue team.
All right, let's, Sam, talk about this. 1947. Talk about North Carolina barbecue, because, once again, I will not misspeak. I don't profess to be an expert. I know what I know, and I know what I don't know. That's my best take at wisdom. So, North Carolina barbecue, describe it to us stylistically.
North Carolina barbecue could be literally divided into two separate groups. If you look at North Carolina, you can almost draw a line in the middle of the state where I-95 splits it, and there's two different styles of barbecue. In my side of the state, which is the eastern style, it's geared and traditionally for whole hog. We cook it straight over an open pit, as Mike was speaking earlier. In the western part of the state, it's more shoulders with a tomato-based sauce applied versus our light vinegar. And so North Carolina is true to barbecue as far as barbecue, in my opinion, is defined by geography.
Hmm.
Whether it's in by state, sometimes like in North Carolina, it's almost divided by communities as you pass from region to region.
Your fuel, I've seen some of the stuff on video. What are you using, charcoal, using wood? What do you use?
Wood. Primarily oak.
Yeah. Which is really tough to regulate, right? So you've got, how do you explain it? So you've got a pit. I mean, you explain to me how this works. So we get a pig, we split it in half, that's the protein, that comes in the door the way it is. You to prepare those pits, are you making the oak into charcoal some way ahead of time?
There's two chimneys that's constantly churning in our main smokehouse, and there will be anywhere from 8 to 14 hogs on at a time in that main house. And those pits are bare bones, masonry about 3 foot high with hinged metal lids that go over them. And a man has to physically take a shovel, one shovel full at a time, and they're firing those pigs. And like Mike was speaking earlier, you can tempt that meat, but as I told a fella one time, cooking barbecue is the first CPR class I ever took. That instructor taught me to look, listen, and feel. And cooking barbecue, you can apply that same principle to.
And when you say tent, you mean put the lid down on it and walk away?
Not too far.
So you really have to. I mean, this is really, because as a chef, so much of cooking, I know we listen to the saute pan, we listen to what's in the oven. I mean, it'll change as things are drying out. All these things, you're really using your eyes, your nose, your ears. It's almost like an athletic event in a way. You're really on. And it's the same damn thing with barbecue. And I noticed when I was watching you guys on those Friday nights, we stayed late that night. Nobody was stepping away from anything. You're on that pit all the time.
And that's really where the beauty is because while you're there, that's when you have community. Mm. You saw the people coming in, hanging out, drinking the moonshine, passing those bottles, sharing the stories. You know, there's not a television. It's really, you have to talk to each other. People have cell phones now. There's a little bit of that happening. But really, it's that really sacred time to be around the fire and to just hang out and be with each other.
Folks, if I can describe it, it's really special. I mean, Madison Square Park sits in the middle of Manhattan, 23rd to 26th Street, framed by Madison Avenue and Fifth Avenue on the other side, 11 Madison Park, you know, all these fancy restaurants nearby. And it's as if you go back 150 years on these nights, because suddenly it's quiet. There's no cars for a couple of blocks.
With a taxi whizzing by every now and then.
I'm going to ignore that. That's nothing. And then you've got smoke rising up into those trees. And just like you're saying, that sound of just everybody slowing down. There's no TVs. There's no music. There's no boomboxes. Go ahead.
Let me explain to you. I've watched this over a period of time. And, you know, the fast pace, the click of the heels, the wheels are churning on the automobiles and honking and going on. But I've noticed this, and I relate this to a beehive. I used to have several colonies of bees. And what you do when you want to work on them and steal the honey from them and, you know, separate them out, you smoke them.
Yeah.
And when the smoke is in the air, they become docile. And I've watched these people as this smoke rises in the air and it becomes in and around the neighborhoods and through the buildings in that area. They become docile. They actually slow down. They stop. They talk to each other. They're not pushing. They're not shoving as you would in a beehive whenever you're working on them.
Isn't that funny?
And it's so true. If you just watch this transition, I've just seen this happen, and I just have to laugh to myself every year. If everybody knew how a colony of bees working, that what that smoke does, that's what it does to New York City.
Yeah, it's funny. We were in Poland and we did a couple of shows, and one of the things was on honey making, and we did that. We went to the thing and the guy had the hat on. We didn't have it on, and he said it's okay, and he had a little funny little containery thing. I don't know what it was.
It's a little bellows, and you push it and it puffs out smoke. You know, you put a dry foliage in it, and it puts out smoke.
And sure enough, and then he would lift the top off, the bees were fine, and we were going at it. But you're right, there's this effect. It's almost like primordial. I mean, Madison Square Park, it's like you almost feel like you're going to hear the hooves of horses and wagons coming by. I mean, it literally would seem like the next logical thing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So talk about, back to your ribs again, to your style, is there a rub that you're putting on them to begin with? Explain this to me. Break it down a little bit.
Yes, technically what we do is we take and we'll prep a rib, we'll remove the membrane from the back of it, we'll remove any excess fat that may be on there, and then we'll put a dry rub on top and bottom. Then we will place them in a pit, and we'll use a wood. You know, Sam, as he is doing, is using an oak. We'll use a fruit wood, apple wood, any fruit wood works. I'm looking for a milder smoke because I'm going through a thinner piece of meat than Sam's going through the whole hog, and it needs a little stronger, a little different flavor than I'm looking for. They'll be on there, and they'll cook for about, as I said, time-wise, it's about six and a half hours to cook a fully loaded pit of ribs. Even if you only had it half full, it's still about the same amount.
Which is a really long time when you think about it, because a baby back rib is a pretty tiny piece of protein. I mean, it's not a whole lot of stuff there.
They're very thin, you know.
Right.
The whole bones and all is going to weigh about 2 pounds, maybe 2.25 pounds at the most. So therefore, they're very fragile. And, of course, your bone is one of the main ingredients in this, in cooking a side of ribs. It is a conductor of heat and helps it travel through and go out into the meat, where the meat in between the bones.
If you had to guess, and I know this is, you could laugh at me because it's a technical question, and this isn't a technical thing that you're doing. It's very much done by sight and by rote memory. What do you estimate the temperature is that those ribs are exposed to during the cooking time?
Between 210 and 225 degrees is what the temperature that is our magic number. Some will be hotter, but the majority of the people, low and slow. That's where that phrase comes
in. That's the key.
It's the same as, you can take the internal temperature of a rib, and it will be about 188 to 189.7, somewhere in that neighborhood, when it's really ready to go.
But you're doing this. I didn't see a whole lot of thermometers out there when I was there, man. Everybody seemed to know what the hell they were doing.
They, as I said, most of them are feeling them, but they'll use the thermometer
to
double
right.
check.
Right, why not?
And on most items at some point in time, 99.9% of the pit masters will use a gauge just to verify, but mainly through, that's at the last moment to make sure, am I right? You know, right. But they'll feel it.
Yeah, 99.9% of the time, I'm sure you're right. Sam, so you're third generation. So Grandpop started this?
My grandfather opened July of 47, 17 years old.
Holy shit, that's a long time ago. Same spot, same location?
Same location. Some modifications has been done, obviously, since 47, and it's and humble beginnings.
Describe what the restaurant looks like, because it's kind of funny. I mean, you have
it
kind
is
of
funny.
A,
the original location, or original building, I should say, was eight-sided. It was an octagon-shaped building, no air conditioning. It was terrible. It was the vestibule of hell, to be right honest with you. But when he started to get recognized for the food he was preparing, my dad was standing in there with him one day, and he said, "Don't you think it's a shame that people drive 40 or 50 miles out of the way and they have to sweat to eat our food?" And so that was when the talk of remodeling, and National Geographic it came through doing a publication called Backroads America in the late 70s. Mm. And at that particular time said that they thought he had the best barbecue in the country. And my family historically has had a little flair for the dramatic. And that's why when they remodeled, there's a replica of the rotunda atop our building.
Like the Capitol. Like
correct.
The White House, sitting on top
right.
of the building. But the dining room, I mean, it's still, you may have air conditioning, but it's not a fancy affair.
No, it's bare bones.
It is.
We redid our counters and everything a few years ago, and I purposely didn't want them to be new. We used a reclaimed tobacco barn that we constructed it all out of because you got to stay with what's been yeah. you for all those years.
And again, in the menu you come in, you have, what are the options? It's so the we know there's 8 or 9 carcasses back there that have been cooking for 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 hours. Your pitmaster or yourself, when he says is ready, get them up on a cutting board, 2 cleavers, chop them up, just all the meat, all the fat, all the skin gets all mixed up.
They bring in a half a pig at a time.
Right. And
pretty much one person chops every ounce of pork that goes out of our restaurant. And when you said chop everything up, we do say that we chop everything from the rooter to the tooter, I guess you would call it. But, you know, nothing that's foreign. You know, that skin, and Mr. Michael would tell us, there's anybody that knows how to cook. There's a fine line in blistering that skin and getting it where it's yeah. perfect and edible
yeah.
and completely ruining it. And so, you know, the man tending the pit's got to know what he's doing for it to be right to hit that cutting board. Because another thing about our place is everything's an open book. When you walk in the restaurant, you're looking straight into the kitchen. You're looking right at the guy chopping all that pork. And so there's no secrets at that point. You can't hide a mistake. And so that's why we try to be on top of our game each and every day.
It's served with bread, coleslaw.
That's it.
And that's it.
And it's lightly dressed. We make a sauce, and we have our own brand of sauce, but we basically dress the meat as you would a salad, so to speak.
So it's not done. In your opinion, it's done when it goes out.
That's right. Not to wrap it up, but right. just to enhance the natural flavor of the pork itself.
And Mike, you make a sauce too? Because I know yours is a drier one, but at some point, does it get a sauce?
Yes, we make our own sauce.
Because you won a competition on sauce, too, if I'm not mistaken. Right?
Among the many other
competitions.
It's a recipe that's been my great-grandmother had the recipe, and it's passed down through the generations. And, yes, it's won several awards.
How many spots do you have now? 2?
Well, I have 2 spots in Southern Illinois, 2 in Las Vegas.
Oh, you're in Vegas now, too. Okay.
Yes. Under the name of Memphis Barbecue.
Gotcha. And you're affiliated with Danny and Blue Smoke as a consultant still or no?
Yes.
Still?
Still, yes.
Gotcha. So what's the future? I mean, tell me what you, because you, I mean, the generation, so you're the next generation.
I'm the next generation. I'm pushing him.
At some point,
him.
We giving up, at some point, we're just going to sublet that Boston apartment.
I'm not going to give up easy.
No, he's not going silently.
What would you do if you didn't do this? That's always the question with his retirement thing. Do you have a big tennis game or a big golf game? Are you a bass fisherman or something?
I used to be. Now I barbecue.
He barbecues 7 days a week, and I love that. That's what I think what makes him so special. Now, I have been really blessed to be back and working in this with my dad, and I think, you know, very rarely at this age do you get to spend so much time with your family member unless you're in business together, and that can either be very butting heads or not, right. And I think we work really well together, and maybe of every 100 ideas I have, I get to do 98 of them, or not two of them, 98 or...
I was about to say.
I think it was 98.
No, 98 or no. Two are like, huh, that might work. They become his idea. That's I've learned. It has to become his idea, and then we get it done really quickly.
We are exactly. Guys. I mean, come on.
But it's really special to work in a family business, and, you know, I feel this tending this legacy and what's happening in barbecue and sort of our role and place in that, and, you know, how we're moving that forward is really important. We have some consulting that we do called On Cue, so we are helping. We've incubated a lot of barbecue restaurants all over the world, several here in Brooklyn even. And, you know, we have various events now. People travel from all over the world to Murfreesboro. Sam comes and helps us do an event called the Whole Hog Extravaganza, which is really cool. We have a new building that we're building out, and we're going to be having a sauce factory where we will produce our own sauces in-house, and also we will co-pack for other people. So we sell barbecue mail order now, so very busy, but very much mindful of the fact that we have this mothership restaurant in the middle of nowhere. People come there because they've read the book or seen us on TV, and we want people to really feel that they are sitting down and experiencing this community and this sort of slice of Americana that barbecue represents.
Well, thanks for coming to the studio, to Morgantown, to Heritage Radio Network, and I really, really, 99.9% of my weekends, I leave Manhattan on Friday morning. I have a house at the beach. That's where my kids were raised. That's where I spend my whole summer, all summer. I don't come back up here till September at the end of this month. But I'm really looking forward to Saturday. I'm looking forward to seeing you. I mean, it's an honor to have the caliber of world-class barbecue from all around this country coming to Manhattan to cook for us. So on behalf of those lines of people, and you know what it's going to look like. When those gates open up at 11 o'clock on Saturday morning, there's going to be 100 people in front of your station, in front of your station, and that line's going to snake there all day long. Thanks for feeding us, and thanks for showing us the way with great barbecue.
Well, thank you for having us here and giving us the opportunity to come to New York and to be able to... It's a good time for all the pit masters to each one see each other, because sometimes we're not all at the same event. But everybody looks forward to coming here and showing and talking about, can there be good barbecue in New York? Absolutely, there is good barbecue in New York.
Well, I'll tell you this, there's going to be this weekend. That much I'll vouch for, folks. It's going to be two great days of it. Again, that's this weekend, Madison Square Park. My guest has been Mike Mills, pitmaster at, 17th Street Barbecue, his daughter Amy, Sam Jones from the Skylight Inn in Aiden, North Carolina. Again, gentlemen and ladies, thanks so much for coming on. I really look forward to hanging out with you backstage on Saturday. You'll get to meet my son, who will be introduced for the first time to great barbecue. That's folks, we've got a great show next week. I'm out of time. I'm running late on this show, so just two more shows to go for this summer season. I got a big swim coming up around Key West. That's right. We're doing a 12.5 mile relay swim, me and two of my New York City buddies. So we'll be in Florida, not this coming weekend, but next weekend. So I'll report back on that post-Key West. Take care. See you all on Saturday. Thank you.
Thank you.
See you next week.
That was awesome.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.